we're back.
Okie dokie.
And the Victorian age has been neatly brought to a close, since we've been gone, by the death of Queen Victoria in 1901.
Great timing.
Yeah. She's succeeded by her son, Edward VII, which ushers in the Edwardian era at the start of the 20th century. So at the outset of the century, we get our London boroughs.
Do we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Before that, it'd been a bit of a sort of muddle of parishes and districts. But at this point, the London County Council, our administrative body.
You love them. I love them.
We do. Defined 28 metropolitan boroughs within what is now known as the County of London. That's an area that we today know as Inner London. And to the west, it goes as far as Hammersmith, north to Stoke Newington, east to Woolwich, and south to Lewisham.
So that's those are the boundaries of Inner London.
Yes.
And they stay fixed?
Those are the boundaries of what we today call Inner London. Back then, they were called the County of London.
Right.
And that was, at that point, considered to be the extent of the city. And it had grown, obviously, long since beyond the bounds of the mile.
To what we now know as Greater London.
But yes, this was
their... Oh, no, sorry, the mile meaning the city.
Square mile, sorry, yeah. Yes. But what they had done at this point was codify the space that it had now grown into and say, all right, these are the boroughs that we need to administer as the organising force of the City of London. So that's where we get to. And we're seeing that.
Yeah, so, okay, we're moving into the 20th century now, and yet poverty is still not great. Mm. I mean, this 19th century saw some improvement in living conditions, but poverty is still endemic at this moment. Mm-hmm. In 1902, this is worth mentioning, the social reformer Charles Booth made a very famous survey of life and labour in London, mm-hmm. and it revealed that a third of the East End lived in extreme poverty.
Yeah, that was a very famous survey, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There's a map which colour codes streets and houses in huge detail.
Yeah.
He went into all these areas.
He
went in. He wandered around.
He got under it.
He talked to people, got into it. It was a whole thing. And he did two of them, I think. There was an initial survey and then a later one. Keeping updated over the early part of the 20th century, the sort of state of areas of London and what sort of classes and working sort of styles that existed in different areas. So it's really,
and what he recorded was a number of slums that were scattered across the mm-hmm. the city.
Picked those out, yeah.
Overcrowded tenements that were a hangover from the Victorian era. They were notorious for their extreme conditions. We've spoken about some of them already.
Yeah, we did.
It's hard to believe there was a really bad slum in Greenwich.
Bougie Greenwich.
Yeah. And the answer to this social crisis of living standards wasn't the most delicate of methods. It was the slums were just flattened and levelled, and the communities who lived there were just booted out and relocated elsewhere.
Right, yes.
A significant clearance took place in Holborn, sweeping away the maze of narrow streets known as Clare Market to make way for the new Kingsway, I suppose, because of the king, the yes. brand new king. And that's the site of the present day LSE campus.
So that was a bit of a sort of infrastructural change as opposed to a sort of housing one.
Well, I think a bit of both, I imagine.
Yeah, interesting.
I just want to flag a defining aspect of the London experience in the 20th century. And it's sort of a theme that could feel familiar to any point in London. But here, there's a strong contrast between an incredibly prosperous commercial city and a poverty-stricken hellhole for the working poor. Mm. And that just hints at a wider sort of theme of London, which is this huge contrast between rich and poor.
Mm. Yeah, that's gone on in some form.
Tell us about the suffragettes.
Oh, the suffragettes. So at the beginning of the 20th century, the suffragette movement, which had been going since the 1860s in a sort of nationwide form, it turned militant. Frustrated by a lack of progress, they started to employ more extreme tactics to bring attention to the movement. In 1906, there was a large demonstration in London where they engaged in acts of vandalism to bring attention to the lack of progress that was being made towards women's suffrage, which is the right for women to vote. Probably the most pronounced example, and one I think a lot of people will know. Derby Day at Epsom, which will count as London. May 1913, Emily Davison walked in front of the King's Horse and was trampled to death, very sadly.
One of the most famous acts of protest of all time.
Definitely. definitely.
And most effective, you could say.
Yes. After all of that and even more, hunger strikes and, you know, obviously, like I said, nationwide movement. But in 1918, women over the age of 30 were finally given the right to vote.
Progress was made.
Yes.
To some degree. Care for some sport?
I love sports.
In 1908, London hosted the fourth ever Olympic Games.
The fourth ever?
It was supposed to be held in Rome, but following Mount Vesuvius's eruption in 1906, a new host nation was needed, and London was chosen, and the Games were staged alongside the Franco-British exhibition that was taking place the same summer in White City.
Ah, another expo. We did love an expo, didn't we?
Yeah.
Back then. Yeah, fun fact about White City. Do you know why it's called?
This is pub ammo.
This is pure pub ammo.
Okay.
Do you know why it's called White City?
Tell me.
You wouldn't. The reason is because the Franco-British exhibition that was taking place that allowed the Olympics to just be carted over here, you know, last minute, because we had basically a large sort of facility set up to be like, oh yeah, we could just host a massive event. The expo itself was housed in this incredibly grand space, which had these buildings that were all pure white, and they were really impressive. If you type Franco-British exhibition into Google and have a look, it's quite something. So that's where the area White City. City gets its name.
Yeah. I've got some pub ammo back at you.
Oh, yeah?
Shots fired.
Go on.
The Olympic tug of war event
of 1908
was won by none other than the City of London Police.
The most mental thing you just told me, that there was a tug of war at the Olympics. Not who won it.
They're not still a tug of war?
I'm pretty sure they outlawed that.
Bring back the Olympic tug of war.
Yeah,
I say.
Like cricket, bun that. Did they just add surfing? What?
Tug of war it.
Tug of war. They're talking about climbing. Like,
yeah. No, but tug of war is your, like, you know, it's your old school Olympic. It's just bread and butter brute force.
It's some chariots of fire stuff. That. Yeah, that's exactly. That's, you know, overly starched bockies and, like, vests, isn't it?
Anyway, the City of London Police won it. And to this day, the 1908 Games are the only games that Great Britain have ranked first in.
Oh, halcyon days.
The halcyon days.
Before other people realised tug of war wasn't an event.
So that was a bit of fun before a bit of a dark cloud.
Yeah, so inevitably, we're going to have to talk about World War One, early in the 20th century, a hugely significant moment in global history, of course, that sees lots of men and boys even from London shipped off to the Western Front, mm-hmm. in France and Belgium.
And obviously we do have to talk about it, but in terms of World War One's effect on London, other than this mass exodus of men, what else was there?
So it wasn't actually, in terms of the effect, as profound as certainly World War II later in the century. But the thing that happened in World War II, bombing raids were a feature of World War One, even in a much lighter form. In 1915, there was a bombing campaign executed by Zeppelins, airships, blimps, known by many names. And later on, there was some bombing by planes. But the most notable bombings were by airships, and around 500 people were killed through World War One, which, you know, isn't a massive amount, but people did die, and they died at home. And I think that was the most startling feature of the air raids in World War One, was that this was a new form of warfare,
yeah.
that had never been seen before.
And an alarming foreshadowing of what was to come.
Absolutely. So, you know, it shook people up, and it had an effect, but it was not obviously anything like on the scale that we would see later on in World War II. So that, I think, is probably the biggest thing that you'd say about World War One in London.
Let me take us back to some sport then. Post-war, in 1923, the original Wembley Stadium is opened.
Exciting!
As the Empire Stadium, on the same site as the present-day stadium. And its first game was the Football Association Challenge Cup Final, known to you and me today as the FA Cup.
The FA Cup.
The FA Cup, sorry.
Kids today, of course, won't know that there was a Wembley before the present Wembley.
Of course, yeah.
A very significant.
But that first FA Cup final was the White Horse Final.
Ah, yes.
And do you know why it's called that?
I believe, yes, I do. I believe.
Tell me.
It was over attended to the tune of about 200,000 people.
Yeah, the attendance officially was 126,000 around about, but the unofficial attendance was 300,000.
Jesus. This was, of course, before widespread seating in stadiums, and actually most of it would have been terraces. Yeah. So, you know, you could cram people into a space like that. And it was huge. It was a very big stadium.
And the White Horse because?
The White Horse is because one of the policemen had to push the crowds back off
corral
the pitch
them.
With his, from his mounted
steed.
Position. And it was a white horse. He was on a white horse.
There's an image of it, right?
Yeah, I think really... it was. I think it was like postage stamps done of it.
Really?
Yeah, it became quite a sort of cult thing.
We should mention that Bolton beat West Ham 2-0 in that final. Just, you know, don't want to
no,
leave Bolton out.
No, we shouldn't. We should let it be known. Sorry, Hammers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, how did the fans get to Wembley back then?
I wonder. I'm so glad you asked me that question.
It just seems actually. It seems relevant that we explore that.
I think we should.
Yeah.
For Londoners of this time, there was an explosion of transport options. A veritable explosion, I tell thee.
I'm excited.
How about the tram? You want to get the tram?
There were trams.
There were trams, though little of it remains now. London was crisscrossed by a major tram network that was expanded in this period.
Expanded. In fact, in the Kingsway Road... still has a tram tunnel running under it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No tram there,
legacy
right?
of trams. Sadly, no. They're confined to Wimbledon and Croydon these days.
Yeah.
So that's trams.
What about the London Underground? Got anything for us?
So yeah, the London Underground, we saw it expand again. In the first 10 years of the century, you saw the Central Line, the Bakerloo, the Piccadilly, all added to the network. Big
and
stuff.
The motorised London Omnibus made its entrance in the early 20th century.
Beep, beep.
The big red bus, baby.
The big red bus. So those transport advances are not just fun little tidbits. They are, in fact, key narrative elements to the growth of London as a city. As we saw in the Victorian period with the arrival of the railway in various areas, of course, that meant that people could suddenly live there and still go to work. What we now see is an even greater growth of suburbia, blossoming, you might say, in the interwar years. Residential
or sprawling.
Sprawl is a sort of pejorative way of putting it, yes.
You say blossom, I say sprawl, whatever. No, I don't feel that way.
Let's call the whole thing. So residential developers, ever busy in and around London, filled the gaps in the new tube line areas, new tube line suburbs. And actually, it's kind of got to such a point that in 1938, the Green Belt Act was passed, which is something that still exists. This established a sort of definitive geographical limit to the increase of London's urban sprawl.
Blossoming.
That is something that is still alive today. The Green Belt still exists.
So.
And it means that you can't build kind of beyond a certain point. In 1939, just before the war, the population of London...
On the eve of war, no?
On the eve of war, basically. The population of London hit an all-time peak of 8.6 million souls, which is a peak population of the city that we only surpassed as recently as 2015.
Right. Well, what's coming next will be because of that.
Yeah. Interesting, though, isn't it? But all the way back then was as busy and as full as the city ever was until more recently. So at this point, we had one in five of the entire British population basically lived in London.
Wow. I think potentially part of the reason that it dropped so significantly is what's about to arrive on London's doorstep, which is World War II. And we talked about... World War One sort of having an effect on London, but not in a sort of hugely profound way. Let's say World War Two reshapes London. Once France had been invaded, London became the Nazis' next big target.
Yeah.
And Londoners had to prepare themselves for the very real likelihood of bombing on the city. On the 7th of September 1940, the strategic bombing of the city and its environs was commenced by the German Luftwaffe. And the raids on the city primarily targeted industry, rail hubs, the East End Docklands, which were legitimate targets from a military perspective. However, these areas were also densely populated with the urban poor. Mm. And on that first day, 430 people were killed in bombings. Bearing in mind, there were only 500 people killed in the entirety of the World War I bombing of London. That didn't bode well. The first series of raids continued for 57 consecutive nights into November. And obviously, this becomes known as the Blitz. And it would change London forever, really.
Yeah. God. 57 nights of it. That is a lot. I mean, not since the fire had London seen this kind of devastation. You know, in an echo of 1666, on the night of the 29th of December was probably one of the most epically destructive nights in the whole Blitz, when a focused attack on the city saw it devastated by incendiary bombing. So bombs sort of caused fires intentionally. So,
yeah, by this point, the Luftwaffe had stopped attacking military targets and were just attacking the city, right?
Yeah. Seems so. So symbolic, you know, almost.
London is burning.
Yeah. There's a very famous image of St. Paul's surrounded by destruction and fire, standing quite proudly at the centre of it all, though. And of course, it did survive. But, you know, that night of bombing in London caused huge damage. I think sort of the most notable was the sort of ancient maze of streets right behind St. Paul's, an area known as Paternoster Row.
I'd love to have known what that was like.
I know, me too. I often think, I'm not joking.
Because now it's almost like an Italian piazza type thing, isn't it?
Well, there's the shopping centre. There's quite a modern shopping centre there. It's Paternoster Centre.
I'm thinking where they shoot, where they film the restaurant love show. What's the restaurant love show called?
Oh, you mean
First Dates?
First Dates, yeah. That's almost like right next to, yeah.
That's like a bit piazza-y.
Yeah.
But that would have been a warren of streets.
I think so, yeah. I think it's almost a bit more behind to the east, though.
Okay.
Would have been where the Paternoster Row area was. But yeah, hugely destructive. That part in particular, just completely destroyed. We also lost some other very significant buildings, centuries-old Guildhall, and a number of other sort of really old features of the City of London.
And just to go back on that, the image you were talking about of St. Paul's sort of emerging through the smoke with destruction all around it, it's probably one of the most famous photographs of London, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was used in the national newspapers as almost propagandist show of London's resilient might. Yeah. You know, you can be bombing us, but St. Paul's stands strong amidst the chaos, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an iconic and emblematic image.
That's the word I was searching for. Thank you. So by the end of the Blitz in May 1941, around 30,000 civilians had been killed in London and over 50,000 seriously injured.
And that sadly was not it. In the last years of the war, there was a whole new horror. Hitler had introduced the V2 rocket, which was a 13-ton ballistic missile.
Terrifying.
Yeah, they're really scary. If you go to the Imperial War Museum, you can see a life-size replica of one. And it's quite something.
Morbidly fascinating.
The very idea of one of those things flying at you. There was a V1. It wasn't quite as bad. It was known as a doodle bug. It made a load of noise before it came on you, so you actually knew it was coming.
Okay.
Whereas the V1 was a supersonic rocket, a.k.a. you wouldn't have even heard it before it hit you.
There's some comfort to be taken from that.
Yeah, maybe, in the sort of morbid sense we're talking about. So this is known as a sort of second Blitz, coming right at the end of the war as it did. It was sort of Hail Mary from Hitler at a time when they were very much losing. And over 500 of these massive rockets were fired at London between the years of 1944 and 1945, killing 9,000.
And are these the ones that are often still sort of dug up? You know, you occasionally hear about a man in Pimlico saying, I went down to my cellar and I found a V2 rocket.
Yeah. Not the V2s, I don't think.
Okay.
I think it's more likely those will be slightly smaller fare. These things were like fucking as high, big as a house.
Oh, okay, right. All right, my bad.
Unless, you know, the old warhead, maybe. Mm-hmm. Who knows? A really interesting visual example of the impact of a V2 is still present in London. If you go to Tottenham Court Road and you walk up Tottenham Court Road past Googe Street,
I know it. I know it well, this area.
You do, don't you? There's a very isolated coffee shop sitting in the middle of sort of houses either side.
It was a Cafe Nero. Whether it still is, I don't know.
I think it's a Costa now.
Oh.
Glad to see that they're keeping the spirit alive.
Though. Anyway.
Anyway, it sits in this very isolated plot, and you wonder why. Well, that is the site of a massive V2 explosion that happened in 1945. It was the last V2 to land on London, actually, and it killed 9 people.
Oh, wow. And there might be a plaque there now.
There might be.
I'm not sure. Sorry. These kind of things we should probably know, but we don't.
Save it for the Tottenham Court Road episode.
Yeah, we'll come back to you on that one. Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned that. Talking about the destruction of buildings as well as the destruction of lives, and the destruction of property surpassed even the worst expectations. If you take a look at bombsite.org,
that's the one.
You can see a map of all the bombs dropped on London during the Blitz, which gives a real sense of the intensity of bombing that occurred in the eight months that it was under attack.
Yeah, there's little sort of explosion icons, and if you zoom out far enough, the whole city is just an covered explosion icon.
Just red dots everywhere. Yeah. So as you were saying, almost everywhere in London, every street is permanently altered. And looking around today, walking around London, you can still see this legacy. If you walk down a residential street, you'll often see an abrupt break in the rows of older housing stock, be it Georgian or Victorian, filled with a sort of newer, almost random sort of 50s or 60s type building. And the reason for this incongruous patch-up is probably because a bomb fell on that plot during the Blitz, right?
Yeah. It's just such a feature of London residential areas and, well, not just residential areas, the whole of London. Many places where you see a sort of mid-20th century estate or block, that was a bomb site.
Yeah,
that's why those exist, because they were developed post. It's real. So the war ended, and we are now moving into post-war, which is defined by, I think it's good to note, a sort of broader mindset change. I mean, obviously, immediately post-war is a very sort of depressed and still quite grim period. There's rationing still.
Grief, I'd say.
Incredible loss and, you know, feeling of the city being kind of completely hammered, obviously. But, you know, slowly, there's a move to try and move on from that experience. And it affects the whole mindset of, I think, not just London, not just the country, but of the world. And this is a time where you start to see changes in sort of philosophy and outlooks on, you know, much bigger things. But it certainly starts to hit London in terms of the effect it has on things like town planning and the way that the sort of cultural movements happen.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a defining feature of the second part of the 20th century.
Well, whilst we're on cultural movements, a moment in culture, we had almost immediately after the war, the Olympic Games, Olympic Games, as a way to, you know, let's just throw some sport in there.
Well, I'm like, what are you doing?
I know. No, but, you know.
3 years later, they're hosting the Olympics.
Yeah. I suppose it was seen as a way to try and bounce back immediately. Give Londoners, to try and give the nation something to enjoy.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And they became known as the Austerity Games.
Vibes.
Yeah, don't have too much fun.
Yeah, basically.
Due to post-war belt tightening.
Uh-huh.
And no new stadia were built, and they couldn't afford an Olympic village, so the athletes were housed in military barracks. Although they were given increased rations that dockers and miners were receiving.
Oh, that's generous. The opening ceremony's fun, isn't it?
The opening ceremony as part of the austerity games included the release of 2,500 pigeons.
London beautifully London pigeon. About that. Yeah, I think it was at Wembley, and they released 2,500 pigeons.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, epic.
The doves weren't available.
Nah, definitely not.
Just go to Trafalgar Square.
You definitely couldn't get those in your ration book.
I love it. I mean, whose job was it to go and round up all those pigeons?
So after that, and this is also another sort of similar, I suppose, you know, let's boost the nation move. We saw in 1951 a famous moment in British history known as the Festival of Britain. And that was developed or built on the site of a heavily bombed area of the South Bank. Notable today for the area of the South Bank as we know it now. It was left as sort of, you know, empty space, and this was turned into the hub of this expo.
So that was all kind of industrial warehousey type area.
Yeah, so it would have been a target for bombing during the Blitz.
Yeah.
Was left as a bit of a wasteland, and so was a sort of ripe for being turned into this
expo area.
Expo space.
It's funny, obviously we talked about the shock, the trauma, the loss, the grief after the war, but actually, I know this is what we're discussing now, there's a celebratory feel.
Yeah.
Not least because good triumphed over evil in the eyes of the powers that
yes.
were.
Yes. I think we can even say just more broadly.
I don't know about that.
We can go as far as to say the Festival of Britain was supposed to be a sort of way to boost the nation's morale and also provide a sort of forward-looking moment, and that was the whole thrust of what it was as an occasion. So Battersea Park was used as the pleasure gardens and fun fair, and there was a sort of docking station there. There was also out in the East End,
in Poplar,
there was a live architecture exhibition, is what it was called, which was all about town planning, the future, and the sort of philosophy behind what was going to be like the new way of laying out cities. This was sort of heavily influenced by Le Corbusier and, I can't remember what the movement's called, but basically it said modernism, minimalism, new shit. Let's do it.
New shit all the time.
Yeah. And the Lansbury Estate was the building, the sort of big architectural project that they
okay.
built.
Okay. The festival lasted for 5 months.
Yeah, strong.
Which is just hefty old time.
Yeah.
And of all the legacies of the festival, London's famous South Bank is surely the most enduring. The film exhibition space, the telekinema, how do you say it?
That's how you say it.
Telekinema.
Telekinema.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
It was eventually moved and it became the BFI, the British Film Institute, and its crowning construction, the Royal Festival Hall, provided the basis for the social and cultural hub we know today as the South Bank Centre. So things are being regenerated. And in this push for regeneration, government slum clearance continued, or rather resumed, in the 1950s, with the added impetus of replacing the massive housing that had been destroyed or damaged by bombing during the Blitz. And so new satellite towns start to crop up around London, Stevenage, Basildon, Crawley. These places are built during that time, during the 50s.
New towns.
And it was in the 50s that a new significant urban housing feature emerged. And so akin to our Georgian and then our Victorian styles of housing that we've discussed at length.
Icons.
The new style of housing
the
for
new
this
icon.
Period was the tower block.
Oh, so inauspicious comparatively.
Becomes a major feature of the look of London.
It does. And as we were just discussing, this is a sort of expression of a new mindset about how housing and the environment, the built urban environment, should be realized. Mm. And this was all to do with a forward-looking futurism.
Upward-looking, you might say.
Upward-looking, yes. All focused on modernism, which was all about paring things back. It's not about decoration, it's about functionality. And it's definitely about giving people new stuff, things that are supposedly going to make their lives easier.
Richer.
Yeah. Not richer though, eh? Because what they discovered, or what we have subsequently discovered, is over the years of these sort of lofty ideals that were written down and philosophized at length by men in, you know, offices, stood around a table talking about how things should be and how people should want to live. That actually, when you got rid of communities at the sort of street level and you put them into estates that were high-rise blocks, and you got rid of all the sorts of things that supposedly would have once formed the bonds and the sort of connective tissue of an area, that suddenly people became very depressed and very careless about the places they lived.
Well, yeah, communities start splintering.
Yeah. And you'd obviously upped sticks. You'd gotten rid of actual physical geographical focuses for people. You know, you'd said, all right, we're going to move you over here into a new house. So there was a very real just shift.
Yeah.
But there was much bigger stuff happening.
I think this is a good moment to reflect on what makes a Londoner.
Mm.
At this moment of time, post-war, we've been through a lot.
Yeah.
What makes a Londoner, Louis?
Well,
in the 50s, we're talking about.
Yes, so we're in the 50s.
1950s.
Ooh, I think even tiny little bit back. We'll go back to 1948 because there's in 1948 the British Nationality Act was passed, which created the status of something known as a citizen of the United Kingdom and the colonies. And this basically saw...
Can't say that anymore.
It's a good thing. This basically saw the encouragement of people from across the globe, from Commonwealth nations, to come and settle in England, and obviously London as one of the major cities of England, in an effort to rebuild and, well, repopulate the country. The pre-war makeup of London as a city was still overridingly white British, as it has and had been. But after the bringing in of the British Nationality Act, immigration saw people from Jamaica, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all come and settle in the city. And this contributes to probably the most significant diversification of London's population that has ever happened.
Really?
Yeah. And lays the foundations for a, you know, diverse, more multicultural city that we, I think, both of us would know and recognize today.
City we grew up in.
Exactly. So this has obviously continued.
And this is where it starts, is what you're saying.
This is where that really kicked off.
Right.
Yeah. Prior to that, and we've talked about what makes a Londoner, haven't we, throughout this series of episodes, you had immigration. You had people moving to London from different colonies or from, you know, reasons why. Maybe they were in the army for the British or something like that. But this was a moment where we literally said to our colonies, please come, live, work here, because we need your support. Mm. And we are going to legally make it much easier for you to come and do that.
And obviously we're talking about the nation as a whole, but London particularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this is the Windrush, you know, this is that moment in history. So it's worth noting, I think, that new communities finding their way to the city year after year is still a feature of London, whether it's fleeing conflict zones, political upheaval, or just to seek new opportunities somewhere safe to live and raise a family. Today, over 40% of London's population are from ethnic minorities, and over 300 different languages are spoken in the city.
But the process of integration of those communities and of those people has not always been a smooth one, as we know. It's important to talk about this.
Yeah.
Tensions have come to a head with violent consequences.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's not always going to be, it's not a utopia, that's for sure. And in Notting Hill in the 50s, Brixton in the 80s, there were, you know, significant flare-ups, violence and between, you know, communities. But despite that, despite the tensions that have definitely existed, the endurance of immigrant communities in London is a sort of hallmark of the city and the population. And, you know, we're a better city because of it. There's a huge diversity of cultural influences as a result of that. And, you know, it's one of London's most defining features, whether you're talking about food, music, arts, you know, just...
Notting Hill Carnival.
Notting Hill. Yeah.
It is, isn't it, though?
Exactly. That is one of them. And it is all the greater as a city for it.
On the carnival, it emerged in the wake of the 1958 riots in Notting Hill.
Yeah, so those riots we were talking about.
And it was literally a bid to ease tensions and create positivity around London's new immigrant communities. And the activist Claudia Jones organised an indoor Caribbean carnival that was the blueprint for the carnival that we now know today.
Yeah, it goes way back.
So this is leading us into, quite nicely, 60s London. In the 1960s, London was at the centre of a global revolution in style and sensibilities. Is this a bit 40s?
No, I think 60s. Yeah, you still had, like, affected speech.
Do you still have the nasal tone?
I think so, yeah.
The famous swinging era.
Yeah.
The success of the Beatles in America, coupled with a pull of London's fashion centres like Carnaby Street and the King's Road, saw the city draw focus in a way it hadn't seen since the end of the war.
I don't know about you, but I'm there.
Are you?
I'm there.
Are you listening to me over your wireless?
That was... Magical.
I feel like I'm pre-60s, but I'll go with it.
Look, what
we'll
matters is...
probably cut
is,
that, won't we?
No, I don't think so. I'm keeping it in. Shit. What matters is that actually this was sort of, again, the result of bigger sort of macro forces. And yeah, like Swinging London is this iconic moment in the city, but it had to do with the loosening of post-war austerity, rationing was coming to an end, and that baby boom population,
okay,
which we all know and love, mm-hmm. those war babies, they were now teenagers, and they wanted to party because they had thrown off the sort of post-war.
Well, they have people to party to as well. They've got the Who, they've got the Kinks, they've got the Stones.
Yeah, get it.
What was that?
That was my Mick Jagger. Yep, those guys.
London Sand.
The London Sand. They were definitive. And that sound was broadcast to the whole nation, obviously London, but the whole nation via a network of pirate radio stations.
Amazingly portrayed in The Boat That Rocks.
Oh, such a good film. Yeah. But these were literal, they were called pirate radio stations because they were on ships in international waters where they could not be caught or shut down.
So wild.
So they were like pirates, isn't it?
Yeah, love it. love it. So yeah, and there's new media at this time. There's popular radio coming in, as you've mentioned. Mm. There's colour TV.
Colour telly.
Yeah, there's magazines, you know. Ooh, which, you fancy. Know, may sound sort of like...
Sounds a shit old now.
it sounds slightly kind of insubstantial. But yeah, actually, but magazines, then, you know, the birth of the glossy mag, yeah, is a huge, huge deal for fashion.
Totally. Totally.
Particularly in London being a sort of fashion... what do you want to call it?
Heartland.
Mecca.
Hub.
So, yeah.
And Mary Quant skirts.
Yeah, exactly. And there's plenty of contributing icons to this vibe. Mm. Twiggy, the Cray Twins, the Jaguar E-Type.
Yeah. Michael Caine.
Michael Caine. I'm a Barry. No. moments such as England's iconic 1966 World Cup win.
Arguably at the sort of zenith of the period as well. Yeah. We go and win a World Cup.
Yeah, the effect of this era on the popular imagination of London is super significant and enduring. And it represents a huge bounce back from the war, doesn't it?
Huge, yeah. I mean, I think you talk to a lot of people today about like, oh, you're coming to London. Like, why do you want to come to London? And they'll be like, I want to go to Carnaby Street.
Yeah.
He's like, I want to get a bit of that vibe. It's like, that was a while ago, but okay.
Really? Do you think people still do that? Yeah, I suppose people still go head down the King's Road.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, because these were the iconic spaces of the time when London was arguably at its most internationally famous and vibrant. Certainly the 20th century. Okay, fine, you know, we won't talk about the Victorian period and how famous it was back then. But yeah. Different vibe. So in this moment of great, flowering, blossoming, might you call it?
Swing?
Sprawling? No, swinging. This moment of great swing. There was a sort of, let's call it a negative swing of the pendulum in another part of the city.
That's good.
So while the West End is sort of popping off, mm-hmm. And the vibes are good, out in the East, you're seeing a sort of rather sad, slow death of London's once incredibly vibrant, incredibly busy Dockland area. What happened in the 60s was that large container ship transportation came in. It was introduced. Obviously, today, that's what we know as the norm for transporting goods by sea. But back then, that was the new thing that came in. And prior to that, it had been sort of, you know, wooden ships, some steamships, I guess, as well. But
yeah,
they had been basically packing boxes. Mm-hmm. But they brought in big container ships, and the London shipping operation no longer was able to accommodate that in the Docklands area because of just geographically or topographically how...
River traffic
and how shallow the Thames is.
Yeah.
You couldn't have a giant container ship come down the Thames.
No.
So what they did was they moved the Docklands, or moved the shipping operations, up to Felixstowe and Tilbury.
Tilbury Docks.
Still... Still the major port of London, isn't it? That's where we do all of our get all take all our goods in. So the result of that is that there is a mass exodus, obviously, of labor industry from that area, and as a result, a vacuum, and the area falls into sort of decline, derelict, in fact, post-war, at a time where it had already been heavily affected by the damage of the Blitz. It also then just goes out of business.
Yeah, and we'll get to this when we do the location episodes on these. But, you know, places like Wapping, Shadwell, Pool of London, St. Yeah. Catherine's Docks, Limehouse, you know, fascinating and really rich histories.
Yeah.
And actually nowadays are glamorous to live in.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
You know.
Very cool. Love a warehouse apartment.
Yeah, exactly. But but at this time it was representing this area was in major decline.
Yeah, proper dead. So guess what happens in 1965?
I can tell from your smile it's some kind of systems update.
Ding, 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 ding. That's correct.
The things that make you happy.
It's just really interesting to think about how this city has been administered and governed in such varied forms over its history. Do you not think?
I couldn't agree with you more.
I know you're telling the truth. So let's talk about the introduction of the Greater London Council. That's right. It's out with the LCC and in with the GLC.
We're making it cool.
Absolutely. So in 1965, we move from the 28 metropolitan boroughs of the LCC, the County Council, to a larger 32 borough breakdown, which the Greater London Council ushers in.
And that's 32 is still the number we know and love today in terms of boroughs.
Yes, it is. That was due to significant growth of the city in the period that we've just gone through. And basically what they said was, all right, we need a smarter sort of setup to administer this. And the GLC was created as a new body that would sort of handle all of the things that the LCC handled.
The GLC had a few dodgy plans though, didn't they? Like the plan to convert Covent Garden into a shopping centre.
Yeah.
Luckily we...
Luckily, we
one.
Skirted that. There was a very significant local outcry.
However, the council did manage to get through a few big projects that the city, I will concede, is arguably better for.
Yeah.
Like the Thames Barrier.
The Thames Barrier, kind of central. Yeah, that was built in the late 70s and has been used a lot since. In
if
fact,
you're a Londoner and you don't wake up every morning and thank whoever you pray to for the Thames Barrier, I would say you're not a Londoner.
It's wild, you know. They use it like 4-5 times a year.
Do they?
Probably more. Like, it gets used a lot. We don't know about it because it's so far away. It's
we'll
way,
get to that.
Out.
We'll do an episode on the Thames Barrier.
Yeah. Anyway, we built that. And in 1986, the GLC also managed to open the world's largest car park on the outskirts of London. It's also known as the M25.
Ba-dum-bum! Love
That's
it.
That's the M25, ladies and gentlemen. The M25. Did you get it?
That is a dad joke.
It's worth noting that that was part of a triple ring road plan that was supposed to be brought in. And the M25 was the only one that was successfully executed. There was supposed to be an inner circle and an inner circle. The inner circle was part completed in the west of London. It's what's known now as the Westway. One of the ugliest flyover roads in the whole city. I don't know if they built that and then went, oh, actually, this is super grim. Let's not do it. But there was definitely a lot of community action at the time, which stopped the advancement of that plan. And thank God, because the state of that having, you know, been rolled out all the way around the city, the sort of leveling of communities that would have taken place would have just been dire.
We've reached November 1970 and a first in British history. The first ever open public demonstration for LGBTQIA plus rights. It was a group of 150 and they were protesting the police entrapment and arrest of Louis Eakes.
Out to a Louis.
Louis Eakes on Highbury Fields. And the protests, along with the Stonewall movement in the USA, laid the foundations for London's first gay pride march in 1972. And obviously today a
much loved
a standout day in London's calendar.
Yeah, big time. Moving from one positive thing to one negative. So if we've seen over the course of our extensive timeline of the city, London's been a prominent target. And in the 70s, London became the focus of attacks by the Provisional IRA at the high point of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. No longer were we worried about Vikings sailing up the Thames. This was a much more modern form. Harrods, Selfridges, Oxford Street.
Shopping districts.
High density areas were all bombed along with more day-to-day locations like pubs and post offices.
Yeah, 1974 alone saw at least 16 separate incidents. To modern Londoners, the severe level terror threat is sadly pretty familiar, severe level, but it's quite terrifying to comprehend the frequency of the attacks, which began in the 70s and lasted all the way through to the 90s.
Yeah.
As the capital, it meant that London got hit pretty hard because of the discontent sown by Britain's overseas policies, shall we say.
Definitely. And it became a common feature of the London experience.
London being a target.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you couldn't have bins in train stations for a long time.
Still, there's still a legacy. Well, they've got the clear bags. Clear,
yeah. And as for the rest of London in the 70s, it bears sort of giving you a sense of
nothing happened
mood. It was a pretty shabby, pretty dour period for London. The sort of optimism, the utopian outlook, the swing of the 60s turned kind of sour. And
sour 70s is what you're going for.
I wasn't, but thank you. I'll take it. It was a pretty disillusioned time after all that, and bands like The Specials and The Clash provided the soundtrack for this marked downturn in the city's fortunes. So through that period and off the back of that experience, in 1986, that's right, we're in the 80s now, and Maggie's in number 10, Thatcher's government does a huge thing. They do something which became known as the Big Bang. And this was the moment where they deregulated the London Stock Exchange.
What does that mean?
Basically, it allowed more external investment to come into London, right, in a way that it hadn't before. And as a result, huge amounts of money started coming in from foreign investors. And this really was the moment when London's financial centre became the sort of powerhouse that it is today, one of the powerhouses globally.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse, you know, you can say a lot, and there's obviously a much broader sort of spread to Margaret Thatcher, the experience, the Thatcher experience, and the policies that she brought in.
As a result of what you were talking about.
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang, and London being established as a global financial powerhouse in the modern era, because it had traditionally been that before as well.
Very true.
But an effect of this is that an area that has been lying derelict for some time, the Docklands, suddenly is set upon by
international investment
and developers.
Yeah.
And up springs London's very own Wall Street,
yeah,
in,
yeah,
Canary Wharf.
Yeah. Canary Wharf, so named for the actual shipping situation that used to sit there. So Canary Wharf, it was the name of one of the shipping wharfs.
Right. Yeah, so Canary Wharf springs up to house the influx of new foreign investment, and an even greater emphasis is piled onto home ownership, something that Londoners have grappled with ever since.
Yeah, that was an 80s thing. Yeah. Big 80s thing.
Yeah.
Thatcher obviously said people can buy their own homes, buy their council houses, mm-hmm, you know, the sort of long tale of that moment in history that a lot of us Londoners know about today.
We are still feeling the effects.
So do you want to know what else happened in 1986?
Go on.
There was sort of another systems update.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Great. No, I'm so pleased.
I'll make it quick, this one, okay? Because it wasn't actually so much of a systems update. We didn't do a whole overhaul. It was kind of more of a sort of interruption of service. So Thatcher's government saw the GLC, the Greater London Council, as unnecessary. They weren't doing the job that she wanted them to do, so she devolved their powers to the London boroughs. But they would return.
Okay.
14 years later, so in the year 2000, the Labour government, under Tony Blair, brought the GLC back, but they rebranded it as the Greater London Authority, which is still in existence today.
Okay.
And it was headed by the first ever Mayor of London, in the sort of not, you know, Lord Chamberlain vibe, but the, like, you know, Sadiq Khan vibe.
Yes.
That mayor was Ken Livingstone, and he had actually also been the head of the GLC in 1986 when it was folded by Thatcher. And he did a very funny reintro speech, which I would encourage you to look up.
What, tell me why.
Should I just tell you the story?
Yeah.
So basically, because he was the head of the GLC when it was wound up by Thatcher, and they obviously existed and had a little council chamber and stuff, and then when they came back as the GLA, in the first meeting that they hosted, Ken Livingstone opened his speech with, "Before I was so rudely interrupted."
Ah.
14 years later.
Okay, Red Ken. What, was he called Red Ken?
Yes, yeah, that was his nickname, wasn't it? Labour, heavy Labour.
Okay, so the return of the GLC in the form of the GLA. Thank God you cleared that up for us. Hang on a sec, did you say the year 2000 back there?
Yeah, that's where we got up to.
So we've just gone and skipped over the 90s.
Yeah, guess we did.
Britpop, Spice Girls, Bucket Hats, Rave, Tony
Blair.
All the
good stuff.
London in the 90s, basically.
Yeah, I mean, like, there was a lot of culture. Heck of a lot of culture.
But not so much happened.
Not so much in the sort of massive historical sense, but a time of incredible cultural movement and raving.
1996, England losing at Wembley to the Germans on penalties.
There you have it. Another big cultural moment.
That's a big cultural moment, isn't it?
It was kind of just like heavy on the pop culture, the 90s. But probably not much else to say.
All right.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, we've hit the millennium.
Oh my God. Happy millennium. Do you remember where you were?
Yes.
10-year-old?
Yes, I do.
What did you do?
I was at a party.
Rager.
I was at the club.
It was millennium after all.
I was 10 years old, and that was a party of my parents' friends. It was a fancy dress party, and I dressed up as a spaceman. And my mum had spray painted two like water bottles silver as like my jetpack.
Yo, that's smart.
And I won the fancy dress.
You won the millennium fancy dress party
of my parents' friends. Sick. And I got given like this huge tub of like
sweet
of chocolate.
Mate, it sounds like you had a wicked millennium.
Yeah, I had a terrible next day though.
Yeah, the hangover.
The sugar hangover.
The sugar hangover. I went to the fireworks. The famous
the London
River
ones.
Of Fire, as it was heavily publicised, but if you recall, it kind of fell a bit flat and
didn't
really
work.
Come off.
Yeah.
So it was a bit underwhelming. Anyway, I stayed up until 2 a.m. for the first time in my young life, and that was very exciting.
Bad man.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, the millennium.
The millennium, other than these auspicious experiences.
Happy millennium, Louis.
Happy millennium.
Another 1,000 years we've got through there.
I'm exhausted.
It's almost time for a G&T.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Let's whip through the end of London, shall
we?
Yeah,
let's see out the rest of the century so far. So with the millennium came a raft of new additions to the landscape of the city. The famous Millennium Dome.
I still call it the Millennium Dome.
Do you, Grandpa?
And I call it the Millennium Wheel as well.
I know you do. We'll cover that. Today known as the O2, the Dome, of course. It's still a dome. But it's not really about the millennium anymore. That would be a bit backward looking. And obviously, telecommunication company came knocking. The Millennium Eye, or the London Eye. The Millennium Bridge, famously wobbly when it was first built.
Yes, yeah, I kind of forgot about that.
All distinctive, you know, modern
The Millennium
things.
Bridge is actually really great.
It's called Bridge.
The view that you get as you're walking towards St. Paul's is beautiful.
Or towards the Tate, you know,
yeah,
all
exactly.
Going the other way. Yeah, there was, you know, bold, modern, distinctive additions to the city's architecture. And those have continued in the form of sort of, you know, loads of striking new additions to the city itself. The various skyscrapers that have gone up there are probably too numerous to mention, but, you know, the catchy nickname theme has definitely carried on. The Gherkin.
Cheese grater.
The walkie-talkie.
And, of course, our beloved Shard.
El Shardio.
El Shardio. People are split on the Shard. Personally, I'm a big Shard fan.
I'm a huge Shard fan. Yeah. Of all the buildings built in London since St. Paul's, I'd say it's one of the best.
Wow, that's a huge call, but yeah.
And it's obviously...
You're right. It's the most iconic.
Renzo Piano obviously put some thought into that. And not only is it an incredibly modern thing, but it also references the spires of churches that used to dominate London's skyline.
Yes.
It's a
glass echo of that.
Exactly.
A giant glass echo of London's spired city.
I'm there for that stuff. I'm so there for that stuff.
Yeah.
When was there a cheese grater in the city? I don't know.
There's on a bus route that I take often, which goes up Borough High Street, there's this moment where if you're sitting on the top deck of the bus...
Is this with the church?
Yeah, you've got
so good.
Church steeple, and then behind it is the glass shadow almost of the Shard.
They're in sort of perfect symmetry, aren't
they? Yeah,
they are. That's so cool. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's right by Borough Station when you're on the bus.
Yeah. Sorry, we were hurtling through though, weren't we?
Yeah, we got
And I think it's worth mentioning, I suppose, that with all these high-rise additions,
Up until this point, London is a low-rise city. Not this point, but up until the 80s, yeah, London is a low-rise city.
Famously a low-rise city. St. Paul's almost used to be the sort of defining height for, you know, anything, and was actually the biggest building in the city until, a really recent date. Can't remember, but it was the tallest building up until super recently. Yeah. And now what we're seeing, obviously, in the last couple of decades is a change to that. And you're seeing kind of mini high-rise areas cropping up in places like Vauxhall and Stratford.
King's Cross. Granary Square, all that stuff.
Croydon.
Tottenham.
Tottenham's seeing a lot of development. And that is changing the complexion of London quite a lot.
2012, Londoners saw the return of the Olympic Games for the third time.
Bosh.
I'm sure. Do you think there was anyone around to see all three? Probably.
No. One of them was in 1908.
No, maybe not.
104.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Probably was. There was probably one Londoner.
No, they were one.
Doesn't matter. If they lived through three London Olympics.
Yeah. True.
We should find that out.
Yeah, we should.
And it's an auspicious honour, making us the only city to have hosted it thrice, albeit...
Until, of course, Paris hosts it this summer.
And LA then do it.
Yeah.
And we've had lows that echo the city's past and have almost come to be hallmarks of the London experience.
The 2011...
summer riots. The 2017 Grenfell fire and the recurrent... instances of terrorist attacks, the 7/7 bombings,
all very sad and all very real.
Marked London indelibly.
More recently, of course, there was that epidemic.
Oh yeah, that epidemic we had.
Do you remember the one?
What we're really discussing here is sort of these
cycles
of things that keep happening to, I guess, every major city in the world, but yes, we're talking about London.
We are. And what you realise is history is somewhat cyclical.
Yeah, there should be a phrase for that about history repeating itself.
Yeah, the city endured, we endured. London is a good like that.
Yeah, that's been our way.
And today, well, the recovery is on. The revival is well underway. I see big things. Look, guys, I think that might have found us at the end of our broad London-focused history.
Wow.
We should get a drink.
What's the most iconic London drink?
G&T. You mentioned a G&T before.
You think gin, but then there's... I could do a beer, personally.
A pint. I mean,
we've just gone through 2,000 years plus of history.
Just drinking tea?
Let's have a beer, man.
I think a pint, yeah.
We've earned it.
Uh-huh.
And so have you, dear listeners. So thank you for joining us on our whirlwind whistle stop big red bus tour of London's history. Where do we go from here?
Well, in the next episode, we'll be changing the formula slightly and getting very local, you might say, as we zoom in on the areas of London and take it piece by piece.
Can't wait.
Let's get it.